My name's Cameron Roth, and you stated that there was nothing wrong with DDT and it shouldn't have been taken off the market. What is your reasoning for that?
I don't know if I stated there was nothing wrong. I said it was not a carcinogen. Yeah. DDT was the subject of a kind of hysteria in the early 1960s. There are a few things to say about it. One is that because it is actually quite safe, you can eat it. And the reason why we know that is there was an experiment in which they fed it to prisoners for a couple of years, and they ate a certain amount of the powder every day, and they were okay. There was also, at one time, a very unusual and much undiscussed study which seemed to suggest that DDT exposure decreased your risk of cancer. But the short version is, it was heavily used, it was clearly overused. The extent to which it remained in the environment, the extent to which it became concentrated going up the food chain, the extent to which it was deleterious to birds, the extent to which it thinned eggshells, those were all things that people were terrified about. And the information that they had, if you go back and look at, for example, Rachel Carson and the evidence that she cites, that kind of evidence is completely unacceptable 40 years later. It's you know, the guy who's doing the eggshell studies, it turned out he was also not giving the birds enough calcium, and that alone will, you know. The final outcome, as I understand it, is that some birds of prey are absolutely susceptible. Peregrine falcons, for example, are absolutely susceptible to DDT. DDT arguably has certain other effects. It's never been demonstrated to be carcinogenic. And the reason why any of this is a point of discussion is that by eliminating DDT, malaria worldwide exploded. Malaria had been the great scourge of mankind in the 20th century. One by one, illnesses like yellow fever and stuff were either dampened down. Most of these diseases were in the United States, you know, in 1900. The United States had malaria in the South, for example, and it was gone. So DDT took the total number of malaria cases in India, I think, down to 50,000 a year. I mean, it was a true miracle. Not that it wasn't, you know, also coming into situations where there were malaria-resistant mosquitoes and so on. But nevertheless, across the globe, it was a powerful, powerful way to save lives. When it was banned by Ruckelshaus in 72 or 73 in this country, he specifically excluded medical uses from the ban so that it could be used abroad. Environmental groups, eager to make a name for themselves, pushed hard, and in fact the ban was, I think, really made final around the world in 2001, which is way too late. By then people knew that the ban was lethal in terms of the number of people who died, and something like 30 million people have died as a result of banning this substance. And I think it's one of the great scandals. I mean, that's more people than Hitler and Stalin together killed. And I'm sorry, but we don't have malaria in the United States. They don't have it in Sweden. They don't have it in France. So we don't care. We can ban DDT and use something else on our crops. That's the fact that people of color, the fact the people in Asia or in Africa, they're the ones that are dying. I'm sorry, a lot of people in this country just don't care. And I think that's really wrong. I'm getting riled up, you can see. I feel very strongly. We have an obligation as, you know, a rich society, a rich nation, we have an obligation to really be positively acting in the rest of the world, and this is not a good example for us.
I'm Daniela Benchstock. I'm also a freshman here. You stated in your remarks to the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco that one of the most powerful religions in the Western world is environmentalism. Can you explain why you refer to environmentalism as a religion?
Because I have trained in anthropology, the idea that anthropologists have about what constitutes a religion, or what functions a religion serves are a little bit different from how you think about it if you categorize religions as, you know, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, something like that. So from the standpoint of an anthropological view, a religion is a collective set of beliefs. There is a leader or leaders who promote the beliefs among the followers. Followers make some kind of contribution or change in their lifestyle based on the religious belief. The religious belief gives them a total view of the world in terms of how the world is structured, what's right, what's wrong, what's good action, what's bad action. That all fits perfectly onto environmentalism. The other thing that environmentalism does, which I said to this group, is that it rather precisely maps a lot of Judeo-Christian beliefs about the origin of the world and so on, so that in environmental thinking there is a view that there used to be a sort of Eden, and then people came and ruined that Eden, and that we are therefore sort of original sinners because we're destroying this planet, and what we can do, however, is get salvation through sustainability. And if you're a good person, you will seek salvation, and if you're a bad person, you'll drive SUVs. That is a kind of a religious belief. That was my argument.
Out of fear, you were very negative towards environmentalism. What caused you to be so prejudiced towards this religion?
I don't think it should be a religion. You know, and I don't know. It's interesting that you said it was prejudice. It's a disagreement. I'm not sure it's a... I would argue it's not a prejudice, that it's a different way of seeing things. The core of my argument is that if you're going to be responsive to the environment is always changing, and our understanding of the environment is always changing. And if we are to do better with the environment than we do now, and I would tell you that at this moment we have raw sewage seeping out of the Yellowstone National Park, so we're not doing a great job. I mean, I mention the parks because the parks are unlike land use, where there's conflicts about should we build a house or should we build. The parks are set aside. The parks are there for us to preserve them, and it turns out we don't know how to preserve them, and we won't admit that we don't know how to preserve them. It's been a disaster what we've done. And so when I look at how we treat the environment, I think we have to be flexible. I think we have to try things and see how they turn out. We have to be ready to change course. We have to be able to adapt. We have to say we're wrong and let's do it right. We have to do research. This is all stuff that fundamentalist religions can't do. And if environmentalism is a kind of fundamentalist religion, then that's not a good way to manage the environment. We need a scientific approach. We need a non-religious approach. We need a way to look at this and do better than we've done. A lot better. It's essential. It's essential for you guys and, you know, for your children.
What led you to believe that the facts proving the hazards of secondhand smoke are misleading and false?
Okay, before I answer, I should tell you that after we're done, if you guys want to keep talking, I'll keep sitting here and we can talk some more. Secondhand smoke is an amazing story. And the short version is that the EPA investigated it in, I think, 1991 or two, and was not able to demonstrate that there was a carcinogenic effect. By not able to demonstrate, it means that you have to, according to the EPA guidelines, you have to have what are called 95% confidence intervals. It has to be statistically strong evidence. They couldn't get it. They did 6 studies. They combined all the studies. They still couldn't get it. They dropped their thing to 90%. To go from 95% to 90%, it's hard unless you know statistics. 90% means it may or may not be there. Okay? You want 95% or 99%. They didn't have it. They nevertheless classified it as a Class A carcinogen. California was the first state to pass secondhand smoke ordinances, all of which I'm in favor of. You know, I don't like people smoking next to me. I don't feel good in places like Germany and France where they smoke right next to you. I don't want people to smoke. Smoking is bad. Smoking causes cancer. But secondhand smoke does not cause cancer. And part of how I got to it was my daughter and her friends were going down the street, you know, pulling their shirts up as they passed some poor schlump out, you know, smoking a cigarette. And I said, "What are you doing?" And they said, "Oh, you know, it's cancer." It's not, you know. And what happened was in 1998, a federal judge said to the EPA, "You can't do this. You haven't made the case. You have broken your own guidelines. This is not demonstrated." It has never been demonstrated. I mean, believe me, there are physicians and groups dying to show it, and it has never been brought to a level of significance. It may have other effects. It's certainly unpleasant. But I'm opposed to passing laws based on phony science. I think it's a bad precedent.
Michael Crichton, you have the next statement.
Before I begin, I want to just say one brief thing about what Richard has just told you. He's given you the story of plate tectonics, but it's fascinating. He's turned it upside down. He's turned it on its head. The story of plate tectonics actually is the story of one person who had the right idea, Alfred Wegener, and he had it in 1912. And it is the story of major scientists at Harvard and elsewhere opposing him for decade after decade until finally it was proven to be incorrect what they were believing. So it is, in fact, when I was a kid, I was told the continents didn't move. It is, in fact, perfectly possible for the consensus of scientists to be wrong, and it is, in fact, perfectly possible for small numbers of people to be in opposition, and they will ultimately be proven true. I want to address the issue of crisis in a somewhat different way. Does it really matter if we have a crisis at all? I mean, haven't we actually raised temperatures so much that we, as stewards of the planet, have to act? These are the questions that friends of mine ask as they're getting on board their private jets to fly to their second and third homes. And I would like, with their permission, to take the question just a little bit more seriously. I myself, just a few years ago, held the kinds of views that I expect most of you in this room hold. That's to say, I had a very conventional view about the environment. I thought it was going to hell. I thought human beings were responsible, and I thought we had to do something about it. I hadn't actually looked at any environmental issues in detail, but I held that general view. And so in 2000, when I read an article that suggested that the evidence for global warming might not be quite as firm as people said, I immediately dismissed it. Not believing global warming, that's ridiculous. How could you have such an idea? Are you going to try and tell me that the planet isn't getting warmer? I know it's getting warmer. I grew up in Long Island, and when I was a kid, we always had days off from school for hurricanes. There are no hurricanes in Long Island now. I spent 30 years in California. We used to have something called June gloom. Now it's more like May, June, July, August gloom, with September, October, November gloom added in. The weather is very different. However, because I look for trouble, I went at a certain point and started looking at the temperature records. And I was very surprised at what I found. The first thing that I discovered, which Nick has already told you, is that the increase in temperature so far over the last 100 years is on the order of 0.6°C, about 1°F. I hadn't really thought, when we talked about global warming, about how much global warming really was taking place. Second thing I discovered was that everything is a concern about the future, and the future is defined by models. The models tell us that human beings are the cause of the warming, that human beings producing all the CO2 are what's actually driving the climate warming that we're seeing now. But I was interested to see that the models, as far as I could tell, were not really reliable. That is to say, their past estimates have proven incorrect. In 1988, when James Hansen talked to the Congress and said that global warming had finally arrived, the New York Times published a model result that suggested that in the next 100 years, there would be 12°C increase. A few years later, the increase was estimated to be 6°, then 4°. The most recent UN estimate is 3°. Will it continue to go down? I expect so. Now, this left me in a kind of a funny position, but let me first be clear about exactly what I'm saying. Is the globe warming? Yes. Is the greenhouse effect real? Yes. Is carbon dioxide a greenhouse gas and being increased by man? Yes. Would we expect this warming to have an effect? Yes. Do human beings in general affect the climate? Yes. But none of that answers the core question of whether or not carbon dioxide is the contemporary driver for the warming we're seeing. And as far as I could tell, scientists had postulated that, but they hadn't demonstrated it. So I'm kind of stranded here. I've got half a degree of warming, models that I don't think are reliable. And how am I going to think about the future? I reasoned in this way. If we're going to have 1 degree increase, maybe if climate doesn't change and if there's no change in technology, but of course, if you don't imagine there'll be a change in technology in the next 100 years, you're a very unusual person. And I also was aware that we have actually been starting to do exactly the kind of thing we ought to do, which is to decarbonize. Jesse Ostabel at Rockefeller University points out, for example, that starting about 150 years ago, in the time of Abraham Lincoln and Queen Victoria, we began to move from wood to coal, from coal to oil, from oil to natural gas, and so on. Decreasing our carbon, increasing our hydrogen makes perfect sense, makes environmental sense, makes political sense, makes geopolitical sense, and we'll continue to do it without any legislation, without anything forcing us to do it, as nothing forces us to get off horses. Well, if this is the situation, I suddenly think about my friends, you know, getting on their private jets, and I think, well, you know, maybe they have the right idea. Maybe all that we have to do is mouth a few platitudes, show a good, you know, expression of concern on our faces, buy a Prius, drive it around for a while, and give it to the maid, attend a few fundraisers, and you're done. Because actually, all anybody really wants to do is talk about it. They don't actually do anything. And the evidence for that is the number of major leaders in climate who clearly have no intention of changing their lifestyle, reducing their own consumption, or getting off private jets themselves. If they're not willing to do it, why should anybody else? Is talking enough? I mean, is the talking cure of the environment? Didn't work in psychology, won't work in the environment either. Is that enough to do? I don't think so. I think it's totally inadequate. Every day, 30,000 people on this planet die of the diseases of poverty. There are a third of the planet doesn't have electricity. We have 1 billion people with no clean water. We have 500 million people going to bed hungry every night. Do we care about this? It seems that we don't. It seems that we would rather look 100 years into the future than pay attention to what's going on now. I think that's unacceptable. I think that's really a disgrace.
Why?
This doesn't need to happen. We're allowing it to happen. And I don't know what's wrong with the rich, self-centered societies that we live in the West, that we are not paying attention to the conditions of the wider world. And it does seem to me that if we use arguments about the environment to turn our back on the sick and the dying of our shared world, and that's our excuse to ignore them, then we have done a true and terrible thing. And it's awful. Thank you.
Philip Scott, you have the podium next.
Brian, may I just take 1 second to thank very much the Rosencrantz Foundation and Intelligence Squared for having the great courtesy to invite me over from London to participate in this very exciting set of debates. Thank you also to all my colleagues for their contribution, and above all to the audience for, I'm sure, going to be exciting participation as well. And I want to start exactly with that consensus word that was used by Richard. Can I just remind you, he wanted an example. In the early 20th century, 95% of scientists believed in eugenics. Science does not progress by consensus. It progresses by falsification and by what we call paradigm shifts. And in my riposte of my 2 minutes, I'll be coming to a paradigm shift that could actually throw the whole of what that other side is saying through the window. But that's later. What I want to come to now is the 1970s that Robert Rosencrantz quite correctly reminded us of. Because then a crisis was announced. And I want to quote from three newspapers. The Christian Science Monitor. Warning! Earth's climate is changing faster than even experts expect. I really like that. Your own New York Times. A major cooling of the climate is widely inevitable. And Newsweek. Back to consensus. Meteorologists are almost unanimous that catastrophic famines will result from global cooling. That was the 1970s, and there are many headlines. And what I would like to stress is, it was a stress on consensus, it was faster than expected, the evidence came from the oceans, from polar bears, it's always polar bears, from the changing seasons, and it's always disaster. Why do we believe them now? And what is important in this, I think, is to remember what that first Earth Day claimed. The first Earth Day in America claimed the following, that because of global cooling, the population of America would have collapsed to 22 million by the year 2000. And that the average calorie intake of the average American would be, wait for this, 2,400 calories. Would that it were. It's nonsense and very dangerous. And what we have fundamentally forgotten is simple primary school science. Climate always changes. It is always, as Dick said, warming or cooling. It's never stable. And if it were stable, it would actually be interesting scientifically. Because it would be the first time for 4.5 billion years. Secondly, humans have been influencing climate for 1 million years as hominids, from the first hominid that set fire to the savanna grasslands in Africa. When particulates and gases started to rise and they changed the reflectivity of the surface of the Earth. It's a long relationship. So the debate, is climate changing and are humans affecting climate change, is actually nearly irrelevant. The answers are yes and yes. And always will be. What is really crucial in all this is something that none of the scientists or none of the politicians want you really to hear. Climate is the most complex system we know, governed by thousands of factors. I haven't time to list them. But the point is, it's like in my country, Glasgow on a Saturday night. Chaos. And what we're trying to do is manage it by dealing with one pub. One inn. And it just won't work. That's the danger. In such a system, doing something at the margins and not doing something at the margins are equally unpredictable. And the question we should be asking our politicians are, what climate are you actually aiming to produce? And when we get there, won't it change anyway? The crisis is therefore in ourselves. And if we are rejecting this, and I ask you passionately to do so for the next two more important reasons. Our political agenda, as Michael hinted, is wrong. There are two great crises in the world, of which the biggest, unquestionably, is 4 billion people in poverty. And this topic is an echochondria of our rich selves, London, New York, and Washington. It's about us and about our hypochondria about the world. If you actually have clean water, you have modern energy, you will cope with change, whatever it is, hot, wet, cold, or dry. I'm a left-wing critic of global warming because the agenda is fundamentally wrong and dangerous. And believe you me, neither Republican nor Democrat will do anything about it, because the second crisis is a crisis of hypocrisy. Now, Michael hinted at this, but I come from Europe, which has been lecturing the world on this subject. Let me tell you, the hypocrisy in Europe is absolutely mind-blowing. I am embarrassed. The latest statistics from the Environment Agency in Europe will predict, under the Kyoto Protocol, we won't even be minus. That by 2012, we'll be plus 4%. And did you know that Ireland, whom we all love, Actually, under the Kyoto Protocol, is allowed a growth of 13%. And some of the figures for Europe are just spectacularly worrying. Spain, Italy, Portugal, we're in the 40% zone. And yet we lecture the world. What we see in this is an enormous danger for politicians in terms of their hypocrisy. I'm not going to say anything about Al Gore and his house. But it is a very serious point. Global warming is also dangerous because I am an environmentalist. But what I'm beginning to see is that global warming is setting agendas which are actually damaging for the environment. Biofuels, in which the energy relationships are very dodgy, but which have a very significant effect, certainly in my country, on biodiversity. What is more, we're having wind farms placed for global warming on very, very sensitive peat moor habitats. Don't think, therefore, that if you're an environmentalist, you have to be attached to this agenda, because it is now overarching, over-dominant, and is actually taking money and effort away from genuine and real on-the-ground habitat environmental concerns. But let me end with two images. Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, my own good Prime Minister, for whom I voted, let me emphasise, arguing in public 2 weeks ago as to who in Annie Get the Gun style can produce the best temperature. I can do 2 degrees C, said Angela. No, I can only do 3, said Tony. Stand back a minute. Those are politicians telling you that they can control climate to a degree Celsius. This is a political crisis, not a crisis as put here, and I ask you passionately to vote against it.
But sitting right next to you is a serious scientist who believes there is no risk.
No, of course climate change is a serious risk. That's not the question, Tony. The question is whether human-caused climate change is a dangerous risk. Now, you very much concentrated in your comments on the film on challenging Martin Durkin's credentials. You then chose to challenge a couple of the scientists. It misses the point. This isn't about Martin Durkin. He's just the filmmaker. It's about the hypothesis of dangerous human-caused global warming. That's a science hypothesis. It needs to be tested with facts. Martin Durkin did that in the film. Here are three of them. Since 1998, the global temperature has stayed static or declined.
No, it hasn't.
Over 8 years, and carbon dioxide has increased by 4%, 15 ppm. The hypothesis predicts that warming will have occurred. It hasn't.
That's
a test of the hypothesis.
Okay, well, we'll test the hypothesis with another scientist.
No, we won't. Tony,
The
second test is during the 20th century, temperature increased and carbon dioxide increased. The temperature did all this. There is no statistical correlation. The hypothesis fails the second test. The third test is in the ice cores. The change in temperature precedes the change in carbon dioxide. The hypothesis fails the third test. Science is about testing hypotheses. The dangerous human-caused global warming hypothesis has been tested, and it fails.
All right, well, joining us now with a reaction, the author of the book, What's So Great About Christianity, Dinesh D'Souza. Didn't he have a point, Dinesh, that, in fact, Einstein was a deist, and many of our founding fathers who are often presented as if they embraced Christianity as it's practiced today, were they not also deists? Who, as Hitchens pointed out, kind of believed in creation, but then kind of let the world take care of itself.
Well, first of all, the meaning of deism is that there is a transcendent God who set into motion the universe. So deism is completely consistent with theism. Deism is not the same as Orthodox Christianity, but if you look at the American founders, the vast majority of them were, in fact, Orthodox Christians. Even Benjamin Franklin, who's often described as a deist, often called for prayer for God to intervene in the universe and help the American experiment.
You know, Thomas Jefferson rewrote the Bible and took the Gospels out, did the Jefferson Bible. Can you imagine a politician today rewriting the Bible, taking out the Gospels, and how that person would be regarded in today's political hierarchy?
Right, but remember that Jefferson was probably the least orthodox of all the founders, and even Jefferson, even unorthodox Jefferson, when he came to specifying what is the source of our rights, he said the source of our inalienable rights is none other than the Creator. He could think of no other source of rights other than God. So in that sense, even the American experiment is based on divine right,
right,
but it's not the divine right of kings, but it's extended to the people.
But the debate between, I guess, conservative orthodox theism and deism is, to what extent is God involved? But give me to the basis of your debate with Christopher Hitchens. To prove the existence of God, is it not incumbent upon you or anybody who claims there is a God to have to prove that versus those who claim there is none? You can't prove a negative. So where lies the responsibility to prove that philosophy?
Well, I don't think that this is just a debater's game of trying to make a proof. It's ultimately what way of thinking makes sense of our universe. If we see the laws of nature, we find there's enormous intelligence embodied in the laws of nature. It's taken science hundreds of years to excavate this intelligence. Look at Kepler's laws, Newton's inverse square law, Einstein's laws. And my point is, if scientists are spending all this brain power trying to decode the intelligence and the laws of nature, who encoded it? Who put it there? Is it even reasonable to suggest that the laws of nature created themselves or just popped into existence? I think it makes a lot more sense to posit some kind of a creator who ultimately reflects that intelligence and embodies it.
You know something, Dinesh, and too bad Christopher Hitchens wasn't able to make it tonight because he was supposed to be debating you here, but, you know, atheists really are suggesting here that the universe has eternally existed. In and of itself, a far greater miracle. I simply say that they believe that something can come out of nothing, otherwise how would it possibly exist?
The reason that the atheists are upset is because in What's So Great About Christianity, I'm challenging them on their own ground, not throwing Bible verses at them, but using reason and science and evidence. A lot of scientists, for example, have noticed that if you change the parameters of nature even a little bit, the force of the electron or the electromagnetic force or the strong nuclear force, the gravitational force, if you change them even slightly, we would have no universe as we know it, no life. We wouldn't be having this conversation. So the universe appears to be fine-tuned for life, and the atheists have no explanation for that.
Well, are you aware of the work of Anthony Flew? I've just recently picked up a book. I mean, he's a well-known atheist philosopher, distinguished professor for many, many years in philosophy, and he, in 2004, embraced the idea that there is a God, and he did it with reason and logic to get there. I mean, if you just use simple reason and logic, you know, you have to believe that either the universe eternally existed, which is a stretch in and of itself, but it also that all these materials came together and that life magically and mysteriously formed in such a sophisticated and complicated and, you know, unique way, which is a far greater stretch than to believe that there's something bigger than ourselves, no?
I think the larger theme here, Sean, is simply that a generation ago, the atheism was not a serious option. Now we have a concerted attack on theism and specifically on Christianity. Many Christians are not prepared for that. They're used to discussing these issues by quoting the Bible. What we have to realize is we need to prepare our children, our young people, to be able to use reason and science against the new atheism. Otherwise, it will have a tremendous impact in causing people to fall away from the faith.
Oh, it's good to see the debate with you and Christopher and see him in a semi-lucid moment for once, and we appreciate you being with us. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.